If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God. This is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast, fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. At the end of the 17th century, a Swiss physician diagnosed his patient with a deadly new disease, nostalgia. In her new book, Agnes Arnold Forster explores the surprising cultural history of this emotion, from nostalgia for a lost East Germany to the 2000s revival of all things Middle Ages. I spoke to Agnes to find out more.
Thanks so much for joining me, Agnes, to talk about your new book, Nostalgia, A History of a Dangerous Emotion. Nostalgia seems fairly simple on the surface, but as your book reveals, it's actually a pretty slippery concept. So before we go any further, how do you define it?
Well, I think most simply, nostalgia is a kind of fond, wistful feeling about some period in the past. So that might be something that you've actually lived through, but it could also be a period in history that you haven't experienced, you know, before you were alive. And it generally feels nice, like it's a positive feeling, but there's a kind of twinge of loss and regret. It's a kind of bittersweet feeling, I think.
And how far back do you trace the story of nostalgia?
So the story of nostalgia begins at the end of the 17th century when a Swiss physician called Johannes Hofer wrote his medical dissertation. So he was just doing a degree in medicine, and this was his like final year thesis, and it was a dissertation on nostalgia. And he was very anxious that his medical peers hadn't been paying enough attention to what he saw as a potentially deadly disease, a deadly disease that he called nostalgia. And so, obviously, his version of nostalgia is very different to the one that I've just defined.
Yeah, so listeners at home might be quite surprised to hear about the idea of nostalgia being a deadly disease. Can you tell us a bit more about the early ideas of nostalgia?
Absolutely. So Hofer's idea of nostalgia was not so much time-based, so not so much a kind of longing for a distant time, but a place-based feeling. So a kind of homesickness, basically. But it wasn't just homesickness, it was a pathological homesickness, a deadly emotion, basically. And sufferers would have sort of psychological symptoms. So they'd be confused and desperately unhappy, anxious, miserable, kind of really low. But they'd also have physical symptoms. So this wasn't just a kind of low mood disorder, but a physical disease. And so they'd have contusions, confusion, pains, aches. And most patients with nostalgia died from starvation. They would stop eating and slowly starve to death.
This is fascinating stuff, this idea of people's death records stating that they had died from nostalgia, because of course we think today that couldn't possibly have been the actual cause of death. How do you think we should understand this today? People, as you say, starving to death or being so wistful that they pass away. What's our modern take on that?
I mean, it is very tempting to try and kind of recategorize these people who were supposed to have died from nostalgia with something else, like maybe depression or anorexia or any other kind of illness that perhaps early modern doctors weren't able to accurately diagnose, like consumption, tuberculosis or cancer or, you know, kidney failure, any kind of internal physical disease that they, you know, didn't have access to the internal workings of the human body. And so they couldn't really put a finger on what it was. But I think actually, if we do that, we lose something in the process. I think it's really important to take historical actors' own understanding of their bodies and their illnesses seriously and at face value. So although these people probably didn't really die from nostalgia, we don't know what they did die from. We can't know. And so I think it's much more interesting to think, okay, well, what did they mean by nostalgia? What were they worried about? What does the diagnosis of nostalgia tell us about both how medicine worked in the past, but also how society, culture, politics functioned? I think that's a much more interesting puzzle than trying to pin down exactly what someone really died from. Apart from anything else, we just, you know, we can't know.
There's an amazing fact in your book, which is there was one Swiss milking song that was deemed so nostalgic that singing it among Swiss mercenaries was punishable by death. So this really was seen as a dangerous emotion.
Absolutely, and particularly among soldiers. So this was the concern. So Hoffer, when he first identified nostalgia, he thought it was a condition that mostly affected mercenary soldiers, so people who'd been like sent away and were sort of paid to go and join foreign armies, university students and domestic servants. And the thing about soldiers is that obviously you need your armies to be fighting fit. You need them to be well. You need them to not be lying around wistfully pining for their home. And so anything that could provoke nostalgia was seen as a real threat, not just to the individual well-being of the soldiers, but to the kind of whole military effort. And you have similar things in the US during the American Civil War. There was also injunctions against, you know, there were all these songs like Home Sweet Home that were also cautioned against because they were worried that it would put soldiers off their form, kind of, it would make the war effort less effective.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
So apart from soldiers, what other types of people were seen to be particularly susceptible to nostalgia?
I mean, one of the, I suppose, joys, but also troubles of looking at kind of early modern medicine, or kind of any medicine really, is that there are as many theories as there are people, and there's lots of contradictory theories as well. But generally speaking, people thought that young people were particularly prone to the disorder. So adolescents, young people in their 20s, so university students, obviously mercenary soldiers are also, generally speaking, quite young. And the Austrian army in the 18th century stopped conscripting people who had recently bought homes or had recently married because they thought that they would be more likely to be nostalgic than, say, people with fewer ties to home, which kind of makes sense. I mean, that's sort of a logical inference, I suppose. But yeah, so generally speaking, as young people and even babies, so there was a lot of concern in the early 19th century in France where lots of babies were sent away to wet nurses. So not so much the initial sending away because they were so tiny, but when they'd come back to their real parents, they were effectively leaving the only people they'd ever known to be parents, the wet nurses. And there were all these cases of babies being diagnosed with nostalgia, or little children that, you know, were desperately sad. And it is kind of tragic to think that, you know, of course, they'd be hugely unhappy at the thought of not being able to see their stand-in mother ever again. I mean, it's so bleak.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to think about. And I guess that an important factor here is that this was a time, as you're saying, the late 18th century, the early 19th century, where a lot of people were not leaving home that often. How significant do you think that was in this story?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a time when travel was expensive, much more difficult, much more dangerous. And so for lots of people, they would spend their entire lives at home. And I think, you know, that picture is perhaps a little bit more complicated than we might first think. But generally speaking, this is not the age of busy daily travel. Like now, we are constantly moving about, moving abroad, moving to neighbouring cities, travelling far, even just for sort of brief stints abroad. But obviously, that wasn't the case in the early modern period. And so it's, again, not that surprising that people who left home, and especially those who were forced to leave home, either because maybe they were joining foreign armies or for work, would feel a, you know, really intense rupture. And also think, you know, people felt a bit differently about home then. There was a greater emphasis on the kind of family, on sort of small communities. And all of those things, I think, shaped the way nostalgia not just was experienced, but also written about and worried about.
So moving forward in time, how did ideas about nostalgia and nostalgia's reputation, as it were, change?
So things all got very different kind of around the beginning of the 20th century and definitely after the First World War. Then nostalgia was taken up by a new group of experts. So while physicians, so doctors, had been really the ones thinking about and writing about and worrying about nostalgia in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, psychologists and particularly psychoanalysts, who were kind of a new profession at the time, they didn't really exist before the late 19th century, they started looking at, researching, writing about nostalgia. And they started encountering people who'd come to them and say, oh, I'm desperately nostalgic. You know, they kind of would come and lie on their therapist's couches and say, oh, I feel really homesick. And in that moment, and for various kind of, you know, small and big reasons, nostalgia shifted from being a physical illness that had the capacity to kill you to being more a kind of psychological problem. So not deadly anymore, but still troubling. So both troubling and unpleasant maybe for the person experiencing it. But also there were psychologists who at this time, although they didn't worry about nostalgia being a threat to life in quite the same way, they did think that perhaps nostalgia, or at least a kind of tendency towards nostalgia, was a bit of a troubling indicator that something wasn't quite right with that person. So they sometimes had quite low opinion of people who were very nostalgic. They'd be quite snobbish about them. So you have all of these, like, you know, quite wealthy, sort of educated, cosmopolitan psychologists who'd meet these nostalgics in their clinics and be like, these are Luddites. These are sentimentalists. They're not savvy. They're not with it. They're not interested in progress in the future and the kind of rapid pace of change in modern life. And often they'd say things quite explicitly snobbish, like, well, middle-class people aren't nostalgic, but working-class people, or what they called tradition-bound people, are more nostalgic or more prone to nostalgia. And so that kind of is sort of a funny episode in nostalgia's history. So it's still not a deadly disease, but before it kind of becomes the much more benign feeling that we now know it to be. But it did lose that reputation. And by the 1970s, it's pretty much the kind of nostalgia we know it to be now.
I'm interested in what you say there about people being snobbish about nostalgia, because you could argue, and you do in the book, that people still snobbish about nostalgia today. Often it's characterized as something that's very stagnant or backward looking. Do you think that that's a fair characterization?
No, basically not. I suppose the book, I kind of call it a bit of a rehabilitation of nostalgia. I suppose in the process of writing the book, fell in love a bit. I mean, people always do this. They kind of really fall in love with their subjects. And I think I kind of, if not fell in love with nostalgia, but at least softened in my own opinion of the emotion. And I definitely think that today people do tend to characterize nostalgics as at best a bit silly and sentimental, and at worst kind of reactionary or vulnerable to populist politics. We don't have to think that far back. So to 2016, when the Brexit vote was sort of raging, it's very common to characterize Leave voters as nostalgic or driven by nostalgia. And the same with Donald Trump supporters. It's often, you see loads of think pieces and headlines that kind of dismiss those voters as only motivated by nostalgia. And Donald Trump was a very adept kind of cultivator of nostalgia. You know, he lent into that role. And, you know, none of this is to say that it isn't possible to equate nostalgia with some of these more kind of conservative politics. But I think to kind of tar everyone who feels nostalgic with that same brush, I don't think it's accurate, but I also don't think it's particularly helpful, because it stops us from thinking seriously about what these people are actually driven by. If we're just dismissing them and say, oh, well, they're emotional, you know, they're not really reasoned or rational. They're just being driven by this fond, backwards feeling for an imagined past. And, you know, we can't take them seriously. Even if we don't agree with them, we do have to take them seriously because they vote.
In the book, you argue that nostalgia is a profoundly social phenomenon, so defined essentially by social and political circumstances. Are there any particular eras or periods of history that are more prone to nostalgia than others? For example, are periods of instability more prone to nostalgia than periods of stability? That's what I would imagine first off, but is that right?
Well, again, it's tempting, and I think people have often thought about it in those terms. So in the 1970s, when it was first when the kind of not so much just doctors and psychologists were writing about nostalgia, but when journalists and sociologists and historians started writing about nostalgia, they argue that this was probably the case. They said, okay, so the 1960s were a period of mass dislocation and upset. You know, everything that people thought was normal, kind of very conventional, traditional ways of people living their lives were thrown into disarray by things like the sexual liberation or the women's rights movements or civil rights, you know, all these things. And, you know, these are positive steps, but they shake things up, right? And so people thought, well, the 70s is a really nostalgic time because everyone's, you know, not really sure where they stand anymore. And we know also that the 70s was a quite unsettled time, you know, high rates of unemployment, industrial action, economic depression, all those sorts of things, you know, were going on in the 70s. And so lots of thinkers at that time were like, okay, well, we're seeing a real wave of nostalgia right now. And that wave of nostalgia is in response to, as you say, unstable times. But the problem with that characterization is that every single generation since, and you know, people before that as well, have written about in one way or another their time being the most nostalgic time, and that they're living through the most intense nostalgia wave. You see it all the time, even now, when people say, oh, well, we're living through a really nostalgic time because of, you know, the pandemic and, you know, all these huge social unrests, they make us feel more nostalgic now. And if that were true, then we've been living in, you know, a period of solid, stable unrest for the last sort of 50, 60, 70 years. And so that doesn't feel that kind of convincing to me, I think. I think actually really what it is that nostalgia is always with us, or at least has been for the kind of the period of modern history, of modernity. It's a condition of modern life. And it feels like we're living through the most nostalgic time at any given moment because we're looking for it at that moment. And so we just always feel like, well, nostalgia is everything. I'm feeling very nostalgic right now, so I must be feeling more nostalgic than anyone else. You know, it's kind of funny, weirdly nostalgic idea to be like, well, now is more unsettled than the past. You know, back in the day when everything was nice and calm, people weren't so nostalgic. You know, it's kind of weirdly like in and of itself nostalgic. And, it doesn't really, it doesn't convince me, I don't think.
To focus for a moment on some lighter aspects of nostalgia, I wonder if there are any great examples that you'd like to share with us. I like the idea of the Victorians looking back to the Middle Ages, for example, through the books of Walter Scott and the arts and crafts movement. I wonder if there are any two periods that collide through nostalgia that you'd like to highlight.
Yeah, so I mean, medievalism is a big bit of the book. There's a whole kind of chapter about that kind of resurrection of the medieval past. And I think, you know, just as the Victorians were really keen on the Middle Ages, so were the kind of early 2000s. And so there's a really big uptick in like fantasy films. And obviously I know, you know, I'm not really a medievalist, but I do know that, you know, like King Arthur wasn't real. But, you know, there is this kind of like relationship between like fantasy and the Middle Ages. And so some things like Game of Thrones, for example, obviously we know it's fiction, it's made up, but it is also obviously inspired by like medieval Europe. And I think that that's one of the things that's very alluring about the Middle Ages is that it has a lot of, there's a sort of potential for play, for make-believe and for fantasy, which, you know, I think is part of the reason why people kind of keep returning back to that period in time. But there's also in the sort of early 2000s, a real uptick again in the relaunch of things like jousting tournaments to both watch and participate in. And there's this amazing, which anyone who's American might have been to, but there's an amazing chain of restaurants in the US called Medieval Times. And there you can go and you can have a medieval themed dinner party and you are served by, you know, wenches and you are called Lord and Lady and you can watch a jousting tournament. And they are, you know, obviously forms of entertainment, but they're also about kind of transporting people back to the Middle Ages. And I think just to make a kind of slightly serious point about all of this is that I think that for me, I'm an academic historian, but my peers can be quite snobbish and dismissive of that kind of like public history, partly because they see it not as driven by kind of, you know, serious intellectual hard work, but because it's driven by nostalgia, because it's driven by people who are kind of have a romanticized vision of the past. And I can admit that I was also a bit snobbish about that kind of public history and that kind of, you know, romanticism before I started writing the book. But then as I started really, you know, thinking about it, I've really come around to all of that kind of stuff, because I think that history is supposed to be fun, really, or maybe not supposed to be, but it can be. And if medieval times dinner and tournament, someone goes there and they love it and then they get really into medieval history, then that is, you know, a great thing. And, you know, especially professional historians should really welcome that kind of enthusiasm. And I think nostalgia is, you know, nostalgia got me into history. So even though I kind of shed it when I became, you know, a quote unquote serious academic, but, you know, when I was a kid and a teenager, I loved, you know, horrible histories, but also kind of all of those sorts of public history experiences and historical novels, you know, historical fiction. I was really nostalgic for a past that I had never experienced. That drew me into history in the first place, and I've made a career out of it. And obviously not everyone is going to have that trajectory, but I think that there should be a lot less room for that kind of snobbishness in academic history and a lot more space for that kind of fantasy and play.
So fantasy and play is one thing, but what about politics? So how has nostalgia been weaponized in the political arena?
Absolutely, yeah, this is the less fun bit, I suppose. And you know, maybe the place where we should be a bit more sceptical of the influence of nostalgia. I mentioned before things like Brexit and Donald Trump, and a lot of the nostalgia that's kind of whipped up in those political moments is a nostalgia for, you know, an imagined past, which basically all nostalgia is. But the thing that's troubling is that the imagined past in those sorts of political contexts is a past that it's supposed to be appealing, and it's supposed to be appealing partly because a lot of the social progress that we've experienced isn't supposed to have happened yet. So one of the criticisms that people levy at like more populist or kind of right-wing nostalgias is that this is a kind of vision of the past that is much more white, much more homogenous, much more male-dominated. You know, when you think about really kind of stereotyped visions of, say, you know, Britain before the mid-20th century, people say, oh, well, you know, the good old days, a kind of homogenous socially homogenous society. And not only is that not accurate, right, that that's not how Britain has been, but it's also troubling because it suggests that that is something we might want to return to, and that, like, these sorts of contemporary political moments or movements are about returning to that kind of past. And that, I think, is where we have to be careful. But I would say that we've also got to be careful not to be reductive or simplistic about this, because it's not just right-wing political movements that are nostalgic. Left-wing political movements are also really prone to nostalgia. And, you know, we've got to be equally careful and kind of critical about those sorts of uses and abuses of the past, not just the kind of more right-wing populist ones.
I wonder if you can give us some examples of left-wing nostalgia.
Absolutely. So two spring to mind. One is nostalgia in ex-Soviet countries. So after the fall of the USSR, lots of, you know, places that had lived through state socialism and communism, and in lots of ways that those societies were not pleasant places to live. They were totalitarian regimes, dictatorships. It was, you know, marked by a lot of want and uncertainty. And so you might think that, you know, why would people be nostalgic for that? But actually, researchers have found that there's a lot of nostalgia for those sorts of pasts in Eastern Europe, in Russia today. And in fact, most people feel, you know, when they're surveyed, most people feel nostalgic for state socialism and for communism. And I think it's important to understand why that might be. And it's probably not because they're nostalgic necessarily for totalitarianism, but because even if you live through a period of history that has been, say, categorized in a certain way. So, okay, oh, well, you know, state socialism was bad because it was totalitarian. It was, you know, there was very little freedom of speech, or, you know, that sort of thing. But people still lived their lives under these regimes. They still had friends, had families, had dinner every night, did fun stuff, went on holiday. All of those things, you know, carried on. And so it's not that surprising that someone might still feel nostalgic for their own life experiences, even if history or historians have painted a certain period in a certain way. And also because it is legitimate to feel nostalgic for a different political climate, even if you're not nostalgic for the whole package. So one of the things that researchers have found is that people living in, say, Poland today, although they're not nostalgic for, you know, the kind of political climate, what they are nostalgic for is greater equality, greater economic equality, greater access to things like state pensions and subsidised education and childcare. And those things are reasonable. You know, it is reasonable to want to resurrect some of those things. And the other example I always give when I talk about left-wing nostalgia is that was probably very familiar to British listeners is the NHS. People are really nostalgic for the NHS of the, like, the 1940s, 1950s, the kind of good old days of the welfare state. And some of that, I think, is, like, not that helpful, because I think, again, the kind of imagined NHS of that period is perhaps not actually how that NHS was really like. But I also think it is reasonable for people to feel nostalgic for, say, a welfare state or a system of government that perhaps meant for better equality or more access to certain services or a more positive working experience. And, you know, I think we've got to look at that nostalgia and say, okay, well, we're not just going to dismiss it as nostalgia. We've got to say, okay, what are they nostalgic for? You know, what kind of things do people long for and lament? And what does that tell us about how society is functioning or not functioning today? It should be an important little, like, litmus test. You know, we should pay attention, basically, when we see nostalgia about, because it tells us something really important about not just the past. I mean, not really even about the past, but definitely about the present.
So you spoke earlier about the power of nostalgia to get people passionate about history. But are there any other ways that you think we could use nostalgia as a force for good?
Absolutely. So this is something that I learnt in the process of writing my book, which I didn't know before, is that today, if you ask psychologists, they think that nostalgia is not only a universal emotion, so something felt by pretty much everyone all the time, so on a very regular basis, but also that nostalgia is a positive psychological resource. And what I mean by that is it's not just something that, like, feels nice to have. So if you, know, sit there and you think, oh, God, that holiday I went on when I was a kid was so nice, and, you know, but it can actually be used to improve your well-being. So there are all these studies now that are done that kind of try and invoke nostalgia in people, try and make people feel nostalgic as a kind of therapy, as a kind of therapeutic intervention. They say, okay, well, if we make people feel nostalgic, You know, nostalgia is a very social emotion. It will make people feel more connected with each other. It will make them feel better about themselves. It will make them, weirdly and kind of, you know, paradoxically, more confident about the future and more positive and optimistic. There are also studies that suggest that nostalgia can make people more creative. And that is supposed to improve memory, improve social connectedness, lessen their anxiety, lessen symptoms of depression. And, you know, that is something I think, you know, I had no idea about. And it's such a fascinating and, I think, yeah, positive kind of twist on nostalgia.
I think that would be a nice note to end on. But as a final silly question to you, Agnes, what are you personally nostalgic for?
Before I was a historian, I was an incredibly nostalgic kid and I read a lot of Enid Blyton novels. I grew up in the 90s. I lived in North London. I went to just the local state primary school. But I was so desperate to go to boarding school, but not just boarding school, but I really wanted to go to a 1950s boarding school. And so to kind of compensate for the fact that that was never going to happen, I would still go to my school every day. And we didn't have a uniform or anything, but I'd still go to my school every single day in a pleated skirt and little white blouse and little button and shoes. And I don't know what my parents are thinking letting me do that. But I, you know, really tried to kind of cosplay this alternative historical life. I've got over that now. I definitely don't have any interest in going to a 1950s boarding school. And now I think my nostalgia is a little bit more normal.
That was Agnes Arnold Forster speaking to me, Ellie Cawthorn. Her book, Nostalgia, A History of a Dangerous Emotion, is out now, published by Picadol. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.
A collision between a Chinese jet and an American spy plane.
He came and rammed into our left wing.
With relations increasingly strained, what are the chances of things spinning out of control?
The Western world was asleep.
I'm Gordon Carrera. I'll be exploring the friction in this most important of relationships and asking, has the West taken its eye off the ball?
You cannot ignore China.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Shadow War, China and the West. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.